Good afternoon.
Bears fans, this is Take the North.
We're going to take the North and never give it back.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome into the Take the North podcast, along with Dan Weeder of the Chicago Tribune. I am Mark Grody of Chicago Sports Radio 670. The Score, picking up the pieces, Dan, from the Bears 20-19 loss to the Green Bay Packers on a blocked field goal at the very end of the game. The clock says zero, and here we are, Dan, doing it again. We're going to be playing cleanup, I feel like, all week here at Halas Hall again.
I had a meeting with the head honchos at Odyssey today asking about a possible name change of the podcast to Picking Up the Pieces. It might be a more relevant title to the podcast than Take the North, because the Bears are now three games out of third place in their own division. The taking of the North is not happening in 2024. We don't know when it's going to happen. Bears are headed for their seventh last place finish in the last 11 seasons. And here we are with our broom and our dustpan and everything else that you can use to pick up the pieces.
Maybe we just add a question mark to Take the North instead. That would be my vote. Take the North? Because that carries, that covers us every single year we do this podcast.
And never give it back?
Let's get to our opening drive.
It's time for the opening drive.
Well, I mean, the focus, so much of the focus at Halas Hall already this week continues to be on the blocked kick at the end of the game, and specifically the process that the Bears had, what went wrong, and we are going to hear from Matt Eberflus on all of that right now. We're going to start with, and he'll cover it all. I think all the pertinent questions were asked in this chunk of audio that I'm going to play for you. But first of all, Dan, I believe it was a question that you asked. It was in regards to risk versus reward. And he was more, Matt Eberflus, worried about the risk of running another play to alleviate some of the pressure on the kick and move it from a 46-yarder to something even more manageable, which sounds good to everybody. But here's Matt Eberflus on everything about that kick at the end, and then Dan and I will break it down.
I mean, the obvious risks are, you know, they stem or whatever, you false start, you know, you go backwards, you know, you look at all that, and you run an outside play, and they call holding. You know, you throw a pass and it gets tipped. Whatever it is, if you feel good about your decision there and the wind conditions and what the conditions are at that point and where you are in the field, then you feel good about it. You take it down and you kick it. And we felt good about it.
How much real-time discussion is there, or how far in advance do you have that decision sort of made on where you were going to be okay?
Yeah. Once you're inside that line there, you feel good about it. You know, Cairo's line, you know, we don't talk about lines, you know, per se, but he was inside, well inside the line for his comfortability there. So,
Matt, prior to that field goal, do you know that Cairo Santos is a perfect 70 out of 70 under 40 yards when you're kind of approaching and thinking about, you know, where you should kick it at?
Yeah. You know, but again, we felt good where it was. You know, the wind was not a factor there. We felt good where he was on the field, and we felt very confident in his ability to get that done.
And just to confirm, too, from watching the film, you said that the operation on the kick was good, or what, the blocking wasn't tight enough? Like, what's...
Yeah, we had to be firmer inside. Okay. Yeah, we had to be firmer inside for sure. And again, we'll turn the play in, you know, because obviously they were on our long snapper, you know, so we'll turn it in and see what the league says. From there, but again, we just got to be firmer in the execution there.
What did you see with the locks specifically, like on top?
Yeah, we just saw him making direct contact with him right away, and we'll turn that in as well.
Does the result change anything for you as far as going forward? Would you do the same thing again in a similar situation?
Yeah, I mean, where the conditions were and where we were in the game, I would say, yeah, I would do the same. I mean, would you like to be closer? Yeah, sure. You'd like it to be at the 15-yard line, but it is where it is. And you could have done a bunch of different things there. You could have ran a pass. You could have ran a play, outside play. You could have ran another play that we punched it there, you know, forward for 2 yards, you know, from the 30 to the 28. So, again, if that thing breaks for a couple more yards, it's definitely a positive. But, yeah, that's where it is.
That's where it is. And just to review, really quick, Dan, the Matt Eberflus's rationale yesterday was that they were going to stack the box. So it was his belief they weren't going to go anywhere in terms of a run play, if that's what they indeed ran. The wind was at their back. So that was some of the rationale. But Dan, you sounded like you were ready to rock. What's up?
No, I was just saying, whoops, you know, because it's just kind of what we get to with these explanations with everything. And it's like, I would do it again, even though it is clearly shown that the calculus wasn't quite right. And you hear Nick Morano from CHGO there read off a stat to Matt Eberflus that Cairo Santos has never missed a kick inside of 40 yards. So why not try to get it 6 yards closer and, you know, play that game a little bit? For me, there were shades of the 2013 game in the Metrodome where Mark Trestman chose to kick on second down. We mentioned that after the game on Sunday, when you had all the momentum going in your favor. You know, the three previous plays had given you this energy and this forward momentum that you could have continued down that path. I think Keenan Allen makes his catch to get inside the kick line for Cairo Santos with like 53 seconds left, somewhere around that range. And so you've got time with a timeout in your back pocket to even run two more plays if you want, you know, and attempt to, you know, kick it on third down, see what's there. Miscalculation. They weren't accounting for the rush that they got up the middle. Matt, you hear Matt say there that there was a need for the field goal protection unit to be firmer on the inside. It's, you know, Scott Daly's got his head down after the snap, and Matt Pryor's on that side, on that A-gap as well. And they just got pushed back a little bit, and it ends up being fatal in a game where you didn't need it to be fatal. And so here we are, picking up the pieces one more time.
We are doing that. Yeah, and I've watched it 1,000 times, and I just watched the ground-level view of it. And, yeah, I mean, it, to me, more than anybody, if people need blame, it does – like, Carl Brooks dominated Matt Pryor. And I know Scott Daly, there's some culpability there, but the guy who was beaten worst, at least the way I saw it, was Matt Pryor on that play. And I don't think anything egregious happened on the operation other than that Carl Brooks made a hell of a move and overpowered Pryor on that side. And that's what you get there. I will also say, man, like, Cairo Santos, he is here to make kicks like that. Like, as far as running the extra play, like, he should be in this NFL. Kickers are expected to make 47-yard field goals, and if you're not capable of making a 47-yard field goal on this team, you're not going to be in the NFL for much longer. So I'm a little conflicted in that regard, too. Like, I feel like I'm less enraged than most on Flus not running the extra play. I mean, you just know, like, freaky things could have happened too. Like, if we're just going to talk about the Bears bearsing things, if something freaky would have happened, right, if they would have run a play, they would have fumbled and they would have scooped and scored or something, like the Packers would have. So,
right, but like, this is where I get into this whole concept of fear-based coaching, and that felt like fear-based coaching here, because I looked it up on Monday morning and the Bears have run 644 offensive plays this season. They have lost two fumbles. Those two fumbles are a Doug Kramer handoff in the fateful game in Washington and a Caleb Williams strip sack when Cole Kmet was beaten badly by Leiatu Latu in Indianapolis. And so you haven't had this track record this year of putting it on the ground and the other team taking it away from you. The other third lost fumble of the Bears this season was when Velus Jones kicked the kickoff back to the Tennessee Titans in week one. And so, you know, okay, we're fearing that. You know, we're fearing a false start. That's more legitimate to me because the Bears have false started a lot this year. We're fearing a holding penalty. You're fearing that your team's not good enough to win a football game. And that's where I get a little bit uneasy, because when you start having such a lack of trust in your football team to make game-winning contributions and game-winning moments, you're in trouble. What did the Packers do? They went and found a glitch in the matrix with the Bears protection scheme, and they attacked it. On the play that was going to decide the game, they went right up the middle, and they blocked the kick. 3 weeks earlier in Washington, the Commanders, in a game-deciding play, found a way for Jaden Daniels to run around for 17 seconds and throw a ball to an uncovered receiver in the end zone that gets tipped up and going. And so when your opponent is constantly sharper than you on the plays that decide football games, you've got a problem. It's an execution problem. It's a coaching problem. It's a team problem. It's a last place losing problem.
I think, though, there is a fine line between what you're saying, fear-based coaching, and I've heard that other people mention that as well, And I know it's like a fine line, but also I think the word conservative comes into play, and that's not as dirty of a word. And I just think that that's what, like, he was being careful at the end of this game. And I understand you could get another 5 yards out of it and make things easier, and the kick doesn't get blocked. But this is such a delicate situation, such a huge moment where you have to get a win, or not only is your season going down the drain, which it obviously is, but then you're 0-11 against the Green Bay Packers. Yeah. So I'm not sure I agree with fear base as much as I believe it was conservative for some reason. And maybe this is why I'll never be an NFL coach, is that I was feeling that in that I was like, let's get this done. Get your kicker out here who can make 47 yard field goals, end the game. Let's get out of here and be done with this and have a great win. And we'll be talking about nice things all week.
Similarities, though, to 2019, and you were there for that Chargers game, which all those circumstances you just read off about, you need this game to keep the season from spiraling, you're in this position, and Matt Nagy chose to take a knee instead of trying to advance the ball further for Eddie Pinheiro, and Eddie Pinheiro missed that kick. And, you know, there's still scars from that game for people in this building that saw a season that started with Super Bowl hopes circle the toilet like that one did. And so these are the stakes that are at play in those moments. And that given circumstance, I remember asking Matt Nagy, I think David Haas started by asking, you know, why didn't you run another play? And he said, you know, we were the same type of thing. We were fearful of taking a loss. We were fearful of this and that. And then I asked as a follow-up, did you think about passing the ball in that situation? And he looked at me like I had five heads and said, pass the ball in that situation. And it was clear in that moment that he had had a great lack of trust in his quarterback, at the time being Mitch Trubisky, to the point where they made a decision that ultimately cost them a football game. It's really, really difficult to kind of swallow these losses. And I know you've felt it the last couple of days, the locker room Sunday, the press conferences on Monday, where players are feeling the toll of this kind of stuff, right? Like, these are two losses that in the last four games that have been final play losses that I mean, those leave a mark, and it's clear that those have left a mark on this team right now.
Yeah, they crush your soul. And there was, so far this week, there's been a decent amount since the loss, and then on Monday, lots of questions about keep me. I asked Flus the question of, you know, I understand you're looking forward, 24-hour rule, all that crap, but this is extraordinary circumstances when you lose like that. For example, yesterday, we played it the other day, Montez Sweat, just as, you know, I was there with a few other people around his locker, as dejected as I've ever heard him, long pauses, just kind of throwing his arms up, you know, Jalen Johnson calling it comical. The latest guy to get in on it here, or at least to attempt to answer for guys like Montez Sweat and Jalen Johnson in a dejected locker room. Let's listen to what Kevin Byard had to say about it. As usual, one of the captains front and center for the Bears.
Nah, I mean, I think that, you know, when, you know, you're asking guys questions right after, you know, another loss, division opponent, you know, you're going to feel defeated. You know what I'm saying? We were defeated. You know what I mean? We lost. So, yeah, it's definitely emotions tied into it. We're all trying to find answers and trying to find a way to get a win. And when you battle the way we battled on Sunday and you don't come out with a victory, it's tough. You know what I mean? But I was just talking to Tez in the locker room. He's not defeated. I think he's more motivated to try to figure out ways to make impact plays. Same here. You know what I'm saying? I think we're all trying to do more and, you know, really do more and say less, honestly.
Dan, my question to you is, do the Bears recover from this, from all of this going into next week, or do we have our answer?
In what way? Like, I guess what's the scale of recovery?
That's a great question. I would say that, I mean, starting with Minnesota, the scale of recovery is, I guess, how many more games are they going to win this year?
If you exactly. Then the answer is no, because I don't see a path to like even seven wins, right? Like at this stage with the way they're playing, with the way the schedule sets up. I mean, you're about to go play the Vikings and the Lions in a span of 5 days. You are so desperate for a win. And I think if you you were trying to ask the odds makers what's most likely, the odds are that the Bears are going to lose both those games. You know, I think they may be favored this week against Minnesota, and then they'll be underdogs going on the road to play a football team that may be the best in the NFL right now in the Lions. And so you're talking about this thing potentially within the span of the next 10 days getting to be a six-game losing streak with a mini-bye coming, recovery. I mean, this was supposed to be a season that, you know, again, 23 days ago or whatever it was, when we're standing in Washington and there's eight ticks on that clock. And if I were to ask you in that moment before Jaden Daniels took that last snap, hey, when will the Bears get their fifth win? You would have said in about 30 seconds. And instead, we might be talking about 30 some days before they get that fifth win that was right there in grasp for them. This stuff takes its toll, man. And I get what those guys are saying in the locker room. I get how strong-willed and united they are and how they're going to get there. But you're talking about a football team that I think the last look, they got like a 1% chance of making the playoffs right now with seven games to go in their season. So you find your inner motivation and figure out a way to climb that steep, steep mountain, however you need to see fit. And yeah, I'll turn it back over to you, but I do want to get back to one thing about the field goal before we sure. get too far away from that, because there's something yeah. I'm talking about. Well, I was going to give you that in terms of just back to you in regards to the reaction to that, and then we'll get into the field goal. My fault.
Oh no, you could right back to the field goal because okay. yeah, no, I mean, like if you're asking me about wins this year, I think that the NFL will allow for something weird to happen. You have to factor that in, and I still can't deny the talent on the Bears. You know, there is still enough talent on both sides of the ball. Where
to be competitive.
To be competitive and maybe sneak in a couple of wins or make it feel interesting down the stretch. But you're right. I mean, the schedule with Minnesota here, at Detroit, home Seattle, at Green Bay, it's
San
daunting.
Francisco. Yeah.
Yeah, San Francisco, it's daunting for sure.
So did you stay up Sunday night for Bengals Chargers?
I did not.
Okay. Let's talk about the fourth quarter of that game. So the Bengals come roaring back to tie that football game after being down three scores at 27-27. They've got two kicks to go ahead in the fourth quarter. They miss a 48-yarder and they miss a 53-yarder, both of them leaking to the left. It's kind of the way the Bengals season has gone as well. So it's this reminder that, okay, some of these longer kicks, even in a stadium like SoFi Stadium, in a moment like that, they're not gimmies. Well, then what happens? The Chargers get to go on their game-winning drive, and they get the ball inside the Bengals 30 with 28 seconds to go. And you're like, okay, what's Jim Harbaugh going to do here? Is he going to take the loose approach and just get ready for his kicker, or are they going to run the ball? They run the ball to J.K. Dobbins. Guess what? They don't need their kicker. J.K. Dobbins goes the whole way, 29 yards for the game-winning touchdown. Scores it. You didn't need your kicker. You scored the touchdown. To compound everything, Mark, they go into a Hail Mary defense on the last play of the game, right? The Bengals are taking their shot from just beyond midfield. Jim Harbaugh calls timeout with 3 seconds to go to get his defense aligned and communicate what are the priorities on this play. He also sends five rushers at Joe Burrow, forcing Joe Burrow to throw the football in less than the 17 seconds that Jaden Daniels had to run around and make that throw. Joe Burrow's got to throw it early. The ball's thrown in the end zone. The jump man, the guy that's assigned to knock the football down, defends T. Higgins, the ball's on the ground, Chargers win a football game. It's crazy to watch. It's basically the same two circumstances that killed the Bears in two heartbreaking losses be run in a 3-minute span on primetime on Sunday night and see the Chargers rise to those moments and win a football game. That's this league. That's the high wire that you're on at all times. And if you can cross it, you feel great. If you can't, you're like the Bears. You're picking up the pieces.
And just to compound further, this is great fodder for people who really wanted Jim Harbaugh to at least get a call to be the head coach here. I don't think it was ever going to happen. I think Harbaugh knew where he wanted to go, but yeah, like
whether
there's
it's
that
Harbaugh
coach.
Or someone else, this is yeah. about coaching competence, right? And that's what this is all is going to boil down to here in the next 6 or 7 weeks. I think you and I are both in agreement that it is really difficult to see any scenario in which Matt Eberflus survives this with the way the season has gone. And so at that point, you have to ask some very serious discussions inside this building at Hallis Hall on what you do to create a level of competence in your leadership, on the coaching staff, to push your team forward in moments like they experienced yesterday, in moments like they experienced in Washington, in moments like they're going to have to experience if they want to ever take the North? Question mark.
Bullet point after bullet point on the resume that anybody can see with the mistakes or even debatable mistakes that Matt Eberflus has made that does not portend well for him. One thing that went pretty well on Sunday was Caleb Williams, which brings us to our QB1 segment.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
All right, I'm going to take you through the categorized look at Caleb's day against the Packers. We all would agree that it was a bounce-back day, obviously graded on a curve given what the Bears experienced in those losses to the Cardinals and the Patriots. But Caleb looked a lot better. He looked a lot calmer. He looked a lot more comfortable. I think it was a big deal to have those two starting offensive tackles back to create some of that comfort. But my defining moment, Mark, is 4th and 3. I mean, you talk about game on the line. What is your quarterback drafted number one overall going to do? And Cole Kmet said this in the locker room after the game. There are certain points in a football game where you need the number one pick to be the number one pick. Well, 4th and 3 is one of those moments. You're losing to the rival at home by a point with the ball in your hands. What are you going to do with it? Caleb dials up a play to Roma Dunze along the right sideline. Back shoulder fade ball. Same page. They connect. It's a 21-yard gain, and it's the type of moment that you're looking for from every young quarterback to show that he can rise up and meet those moments. You heard from Kevin Byard on Monday talking about how the belief with an entire football team swells when your quarterback can get those games in his hands and then deliver the way Caleb did. 3 consecutive completions on that final drive to push the Bears into field goal range. We all know what happened from there, but boy, oh boy, in terms of game-defining moments and adding that to what he did in the fourth quarter in Washington, leading 2 drives, including one that produced the go-ahead touchdown, this is encouraging. And I think you'd agree that was a big step forward for Caleb.
I mean, and again, after being sacked twice, I thought this is it. They're going to get their asses booed off the field. And then he comes up with those 2 big-time plays. I love that it was Roma Dunze, because no matter how good DJ Moore and Keenan Allen are, the future of this team is that quarterback and that wide receiver. Although, you know, don't sleep on the 12-yard pass to Keenan Allen. So this is the second game now this year where it looked like the Bears were going to lose the game, but Caleb Williams, like in the Washington game, which was death in the end, makes some big time fourth quarter plays. And Dan, that is the thing that the missing link starts with, that a quarterback that you win because of. And that's a great example you just gave of it.
Fourth quarter, game on the line. We spent so many years asking Justin Fields to rise up and clear that bar. He never could. Caleb's not getting credit for these wins that weren't against the Commanders and Packers, but there were still some encouraging flashes there. Not a lot of uh-oh for me this week. The uh-oh moment or the uh-oh category here was hard to fill. This is not Caleb's fault. The Packers got the ball first and they went down and scored a touchdown. It's 7-0 right off the bat. It's 10 games in a row this season that the Bears have trailed. Their opponent has scored first in every single game. And so the Bears tried to answer with their opening drive. They got 3 out of it, but they didn't get 7. And so you're talking about a football team that has still been playing from behind and starting too slow overall all season. Better yesterday, you did squeeze points, and now your first quarter point total for the season is up to 13. Good job, Bears. You got 3 more on that ledger on Sunday afternoon, but you'd like to see them take control of a game at some point early where you have the lead early and you're just playing everything on your terms. So that is a little bit of an asterisk, but that's my uh-oh from Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, I mean, you do. Like, you, I mean, Thomas Brown out here, you're organized, you're working on these plays all week long, and for whatever reason, they just get dented early on and then get their acts together as the game goes on. I don't know if there's a simple answer to it, because we've been trying to figure it out and asking players in the locker room and at the lectern all season long, why are you guys not quite ready to play? But it got closer this week anyway.
No question. And so baby steps, right? We're going to baby step as best as we can. My on the bright side is the 71 rushing yards that Caleb Williams, was it 71 or 70? I think it's 70, 9 for 70. That he produced on Sunday afternoon, 71 for DeAndre Swift. That's where I was getting
very good.
But you had a quarterback that used his legs as a weapon. Sometimes it was by design. They ran some zone read concepts, and Caleb made good decisions and kept the momentum going forward. Other times it was because he recognized that he had lanes. You know, he's dropping back to pass. You get some extra pressure coming your way, and you see that you're defensive backs have their backs turned, and he took off a few times and moved the chains with scrambles that were really, really impressive. And I think that's something that Thomas Brown and Caleb Williams and everyone involved in this offense has to remember here in the short term, is that Caleb can be a weapon as a runner when he does it smartly and when he does it efficiently. And that was certainly the case on Sunday. It helped create some of that offensive momentum going forward, and the Bears had a really good day on the ground, and it was a three-headed monster, really, with Caleb, DeAndre Swift, and Roschon Johnson.
Yep, Caleb looked very decisive, and there were some obvious moments where you're looking at it from the press box, and I'm sure the same thing at field level. Go take it. And he even admitted there was at least one time where
Keenan was open, right?
Right, had beaten his guy and he took off prematurely, which I'm sure was disappointing for Keenan Allen, but at least Caleb recognized that. You know what I mean? Like, that was something, like in the Justin Fields era, Justin Fields said there were times he would take off and he didn't even know why. Like, he was like, why am I doing this? There's guys open down the field. I'm just doing this because he had high success doing it. But at least in this case, on the bright side, as you said, Caleb noticed that.
And what that does is it creates a strain on a defense. Right now they've got to be a little bit more controlled with their rush, and that allows you to be more comfortable when you do drop back to pass. And so hopefully he can continue to build on that. Really good to see him a little bit more calm, a little bit more comfortable back there and making plays like that. My big number to close the QB1 segment up is one. It's the number of interceptions Caleb Williams has thrown in the last 7+ games. This goes back to Indianapolis. And since that interception in Indianapolis that he threw in the second half, he has gone 227 passing attempts with only one pick. And that one pick was the one in London that we know was underthrown and a pretty poor throw. But you've got a quarterback who has taken coaching in his rookie season. We can have the debate on whether it's good coaching or not, on whether he's becoming overly conservative or not, but ball security has been a priority here, and Caleb has mastered that here over the last 7+ games with only one interception thrown. You want to see him start to get more explosive plays to go along with the lack of turnovers. That will be when the offense really starts to hum, but I think you can circle that as a positive, that as a rookie, his ball security has been pretty solid.
Great stuff. Yeah, and look, I mean, people are hearing a lot more people saying, jumping on that bandwagon of just let it fly, man. Don't worry about throwing interceptions. I can guarantee you if he was throwing two picks a game or one bad pick a game, he would just be getting raked over the coals. He'd be getting eviscerated. He'd be like, it's the same old stuff. Can't read a defense. He's thrown it in, like, so I think people need to be a little more careful when they talk about, like, just let it fly. That this is something that should be applauded, and I'm glad that you brought that up. Let me play one piece of sound here from Matt Eberflus on the Thomas Brown effect of this game, and he starts with the way he was using DJ Moore.
Yeah, it was good. You know, DJ is obviously really good right after catch. You know, so the more times you can get him, you know, and he does a lot of things well, but that's one thing he does well. He's like a running back with the ball in his hand. So got great contact balance. You saw that on those screen passes, and I showed those in the team room today. And, you know, the effort that other guys put in to those plays, you know, the other receivers, Keenan, Rome, all the guys blocking for him, the linemen doing the kickout blocks. And it was really, really good in terms of the execution, but the effort was even better.
Caleb mentioned last night that he got the plays in quicker from Thomas, just, you know, in his helmet. It seemed like a small thing, but was that something you guys were aware of with Shane, that it may have been coming in a little slower than Caleb would want?
Yeah, I do like the tempo in which we operated, you know, in terms of play caller to the quarterback, quarterback to the offense, getting to the line of scrimmage. That was way better in terms of the energy and the timing of it. And that's going to be good going forward, too.
Well, that's pretty huge right there from Andy Bufalos to say way better in terms of that process. And it just makes you wonder how sloppy that part was with Shane Waldron.
Well, so like you have the decision now to circle that as either encouraging or damning, right? Because you have on one hand, you have, oh, man, like we found some solutions to get ourselves back on track. Well, it's week 12 now. It was week 11 going into it. And some of the comments even Sunday after the game about how Thomas Brown bought all of the offensive units in from out of their silos, and they had good collaboration and everyone was on the same page. And it was like, man, this was this huge illuminating breakthrough moment for the Bears offense. Well, why was it happening in mid-November as opposed to, you know, September 10th or whatever it may be? And so, look, like I do think there was energy there. I will point this out because Mark Potash gave us this stat last week before the game was played. Thomas Brown had six games as an offensive play caller to close the season last year. His best game was against the Green Bay Packers when the Panthers scored 30 points and had 393 yards. And then they followed the next 2 weeks by getting shut out. And so this is a one-game sample size. It's a flash that makes you feel good, but we need to see 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks of this before we draw any sort of big picture conclusions. Because remember, we left London talking about how the Bears had scored 5 touchdowns in back-to-back games for the first time in the Super Bowl era, and it was like, hey, where do we send the flowers for Shane Waldron? And here we are several weeks later, and Shane Waldron's flowers are for you know, the funeral that's being held for his time at Hallis Hall.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I mean, it was kind of predictable that the offense would look better and the operation would be sharper just because that's the way it goes. And all Thomas Brown had to do for this first game, to your point, Dan, is be different. Clear low bar, be different. Do things, the things that the players complained about, of which we don't know everything, do the opposite of what Shane Waldron did. So it was very easy to please the players in this week. But who knows? I mean, the chances say, the percentages say, Dan, Thomas Brown probably won't work out as the Bears offensive coordinator.
Well, right. And particularly if his head coach is on borrowed time here, which it seems to be. This is a conversation for later in the week, but I'll just touch on it. We talked going into the Cardinals week about Buda Baker and some of the unorthodox things that the Cardinals defense does to young quarterbacks. Well, Brian Flores is going to give you looks that are going to make your head spin. And if you're Caleb Williams facing that for the first time, trying to figure out where the pressure is coming from, when the pressure is coming, trying to diagnose it all, trying to react after you have the ball in your hand post snap, good luck. You know, and so this is a huge, huge challenge. If the Bears can look, the Vikings defense isn't like a world beater by any means, but the things that they do to test a young quarterback are going to be very challenging. And so the Bears better be ready to, as we talked about last week, master the game plan and try to slow down some of that rush that the Vikings bring. And remember, you were here last year. Luke Getsy went to a like heavily behind the line of scrimmage passing attack in Minnesota to try to help Justin Fields with that and got killed for trying to find some small answers for his overwhelmed quarterback to be able to complete footballs. You may have to do some things that seem really rudimentary and really basic and against the football instincts of most people in Chicago just to protect your rookie quarterback from himself. But again, we can get into that later in the week after we've talked to more people inside the building here.
We definitely will. For now, let's get to our 2 minute drill.
The 2 minute drill. The 2 minute drill.
Couple of injury things here, Dan. Ryan Bates in concussion protocol. Elijah Hicks rolled his ankle. We were told that Tevin Jenkins has a chance to, quote, probably or potentially get back in there next week. So that's a good thing. And I thought there was some interesting stuff here from Kevin Byard on Jaquan Brisker, because I was hearing some things yesterday that Jaquan Brisker really wanted to play, and they might have been considering clearing him to play, and then they decided not to, and in fact put him on injured reserve. So I don't know if somebody thought better, a family member perhaps, the coach, somebody who's really looking out for Jaquan Brisker, who is obviously anxious to play, but that was kind of floating around a little bit. Let's hear from Kevin Byard on his thoughts on Brisker. I'll also need a ruling at the end of this Byard cut on how I did recovering from a bad question that I started to ask. So I'm going to need you and Studs to tell me, did I recover okay or no? But I just thought that this is very interesting from Kevin Byard on Brisker, who, again, didn't play because of a concussion. Here it is.
Yeah, I mean, I've been talking to him pretty much every day. Right if he's at the house, I'm on the phone. But see him in the locker room all the time. It's just a tough situation within, you know, obviously before he was hurt, he was playing lights out. And to go down with a concussion and to be out for so long, it's tough. I've never had a concussion since I've been in the league, or especially, you know, ones that he's had. So it's very hard. Like, I don't, you know, it's almost like I don't really know what he's going through. You know what I'm saying? Obviously talking to him and he telling him about his symptoms and things like that. It's just tough for him because I know he wants to be out there helping the team. You know, when he was able to be in means, he was trying to be in means, trying to be helpful and things like that. So it's just a tough situation overall. Just really just kind of feel for him in this situation because I know how much he wants to be out there to help the team.
I know, obviously, you don't have any say in the matter. It's a touchy subject, but do you think he plays again this year?
You know, that ain't up to me. I don't know why you asked that if you knew I ain't had nothing to do with it. You know what I mean? Totally fair. Yeah, I don't.
I should put it as, from talking to him, does he sound like a guy who is determined to and thinks he's going to play again? How about that?
Well, I know he wanted to play this week. I mean, me talking to him in the locker room, like, he's always, I'm getting better. Try to be out here next week, boom, boom, and, you know, I guess whatever the protocol stuff is, like, I don't know. I've never been in protocol, so I don't know. I just been explaining a little bit. It's like a step process. If you miss one step, you got to start all the way back over. But I know he's determined. He wants to play. Like, I talked to him before he put him on IR. I talked to him after he put him on IR. He's working to get back. That's all I know. He's working to get back for sure.
Dan, your reaction to all of it?
First and foremost, I believe he recovered very well from that question. I think KB's a good sport about those types of things.
Thank God it was him.
I appreciated that he laughed back as he was giving you a little grief there in the moment. You know, Ryan Poles had said on the pregame show before Sunday's game that one of the reasons that they are being cautious with Jaquan Brisker is because he's missed a lot of football here and hasn't really been able to do a lot to stay in football shape over the last month plus. And so that was part of their calculus in putting him on injured reserve. But it is a very sensitive, delicate matter. And everybody that has been trying to deal with it is you know, kind of walking that slippery slope of trying to figure out what's right and what makes the most sense. This is a decision that kind of takes it out of the player's hands at that point. You're on injured reserve, and that's a minimum of 4 weeks. And then you just got to weigh things where they will be when we get to December, right, to see where Jaquan Brisker's at that time. But I think he did a nice job recovering with that question. Look, like I told Caleb Williams in the postgame Sunday, you walk out of here a loser. And he said, not a loser. And I didn't have a chance to recover and correct myself in that moment. He was a loser of the football game, and I didn't intend to say, hey, you know, because your kicker missed a kick, you're now a loser, and you should be shunned.
The irony is I set up my preamble there. Sometimes we set up a preamble, like a little reporter trick is you try to get some of that stuff out of the way, because I didn't want him to just answer by saying, it's out of my hands, you know. Okay, so I answer, I understand it's out of your hands, I understand all of this, so give me a different answer. But it backfired on me just a little bit. But in the bigger picture of things, I'm glad they put Jaquan Brisker on injured reserve. I'm glad that they're being, if it is an abundance of caution, I'm glad that they're doing this for him, because he's a 20-something kid who is a really good football player who, if left to his own devices, is going to tell everybody he's fine and he's good to go and he's going to play.
Yeah, and man, it's a tough situation, and so hopefully everything works out long term in that regard.
Yeah, what else you got in the 2-minute drill here? What am I leaving out?
I got two quick things for you. The first one would be a trivia question, and I want you to pause and think about it when I ask this, because I want our audience at home to be able to play for about 10 or 12 seconds. But I asked this question in the media room today. You were not listening at the time. You were so focused that you didn't hear it. Who is the last Chicago Bears player to score a touchdown in a win over the Green Bay Packers?
Tariq Cohen.
That answer was given, and that answer is wrong.
Okay. 2018. I know it's 2018. I was there. I was on the sideline. I should know this kind. I know Jordan Howard scored, plunged up the middle for like a 15-yard touchdown run. Jordan Howard? God.
Studs, you got a guess on this? Are you listening enough to take a guess at this?
Was it?
So I actually saw your tweet about this, Dan, so I don't think it's fair.
Don't guess.
Okay. You're not fair.
Don't guess. Let me keep guessing here. Okay. Anthony Miller. No, not Anthony Miller. I think I know. Was he the U tight end by any chance?
You're U in there.
Tight end because Trey Burton. I did not know that he scored the last touchdown of that. I guess the most recent relative to this, but Trey Burton did score a touchdown in that game, as I recall.
Trey Burton. That's where we got to go back to for the last time that the Bears scored a touchdown and a win over the Packers. Trey Burton. So
that's unbelievable.
Have fun with that trivia question. My other thing comes right back to what we were talking about, and it's back and forth between media and the players. And so, look, like, we've been on a stretch here now where it's been four straight weeks of just heartbreaking losses. And every once in a while, you're like, I can't just bombard these guys with the negativity and the depression and the dejection that everyone's feeling right now. And so Braxton Jones came to the lectern on Monday, and we decided to butter him up with an early question about the block he had on DeAndre Swift's touchdown run. That's fair game. That's what you want to do in these situations. Get them loosened up and relaxed. Yeah. But we got to about the seventh or eighth question to Braxton Jones about that one block and that one touchdown run. And I was thinking, man, we're taking this a little bit too far. I said to Colleen Kane, my colleague at the Tribune, I said, we were right at that threshold where you were going to have to write like 3,000 words this week on that block that Braxton Jones had, just to justify all the questions that were asked inside the media room, just to lighten the mood a little bit. But we did follow up by, by the way, Braxton, what happened on that bull rush that Rashawn Gary hit you with that led to the 9-yard sack, 8-yard sack of Caleb Williams? So Braxton was a good sport, but I think we did a good job and then overdid it a little bit there.
Here's why that's good, though, Dan. Here's why it's good. It's a make good, because usually when we're talking to offensive linemen, 3/4 of the questions are about the quarterback, usually. No matter who the quarterback has been, whether it was Mitch or Justin or now Caleb, it's usually about the quarterback and everybody else around there. And usually offensive linemen are very happy to talk about other people. It was nice that there was one solitary, awesome, badass play that Braxton Jones made that we could all just pick apart and do our own little documentary on.
You see this, like, those are watching us on YouTube, you see this mural of snapshots from Bears history. We need to have like 3 of them of the Braxton Jones block up by the end of the week to commemorate it. And I'll say this, maybe for Listen to This at the end of this week, we take our top 10 butter up questions of the week, and we just stack them together without answers, and we just show the media's attempt to not just live in the hole of what is it now? I don't know what we call it. Despondency, crestfallenness, whatever you want to label it, that's been existing here for more than a month. I'm looking outside the window here on Monday evening, and there's a pretty heavy downpour going on right now, which is pretty symbolic.
Honestly, it always seems like it's crappy out on Mondays. Of like, people say, oh, the sun came out today. No, it did not, actually. The sun
poured. It poured really hard.
The sun indeed did not make it out. No, we are not moving on with our – yeah, we'll give you more on report process every once in a while.
It's fun.
We're literally at Hal's Hall. We'll take you behind. I'll ask you why my question sounded dumb, but I'll tell you the process. And, you know, if you're a journalism student, you know, Dan's U of I, I'm Illinois State, we learn these little tricks along the way, and the experience is unbelievable. That is it for today. Thank you, everybody, for listening and watching and liking. We appreciate that, and your feedback is awesome. So we hope you keep supporting the Take the North podcast. For Dan Wiederer of the Chicago Tribune, for Adam Studzinski, our executive producer, I'm Mark Grody, and this is Take the North.
Picking up the pieces. Great talk. See you out there.
Thank you, everybody. Bears.